This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Two TV comics with relatively untamed senses of humor are being showcased next week in new DVD box set collections. One is Drew Carey, the other is Harry Anderson. Today, we revisit Terry's interviews with them both, starting with Drew Carey. The Drew Carey Show premiered in 1995 on ABC and ran for 9 years. Even though it was a mainstream hit, it had an outsider's sensibility. Carey came from Cleveland, Ohio, and filled his workplace sitcom with oddball talent. Talent like Kathy Kinney, who played the abrasive Mimi, and Ryan Stiles, who would also be one of the standout stars of Carey's improv comedy series, Whose Line Is It Anyway? As a stand-up comic, Carey loved to push the envelope with suggestive or potentially offensive material. And even on The Drew Carey Show, he made a practice of delighting audiences while aggravating censors. Here he is taping a workplace video on sexual harassment with help from co-stars Diedrich Bader and Krista Miller.
Hey, Drew, can I talk to you for a minute?
Yeah, sure, sit down.
This is kind of hard for me to talk about, but I think my boss might be coming on to me, and I'm not sure what to do.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I was staring at your breasts. This is sexual harassment, and I'm Drew Carey. It's important to define what is and isn't appropriate behavior in the workplace. The difference can be something as subtle as tone of voice. For example.
Yes, ma'am? You wanted a package delivered?
Yeah, just one question. Can I get it overnight?
No problem there. But change the tone of voice and...
Yes, ma'am? You wanted a package delivered?
Yeah, just one question. Can I get it overnight?
I don't know.
If I can't get it overnight, can you guarantee it by morning?
Whoa! She stopped talking about a real package a long time ago.
When not on a sitcom, Drew Carey tends to push even further in several directions. Once, when hosting a Television Critics Association award show, Carey told some jokes that made the aristocrats seem tame, even though General Fred Rogers was one of the honorees that night, sitting right in front of him. Afterward, Rogers shook it off sweetly, saying, "That was just Drew enjoying being a bad boy." He does seem to enjoy it, too. His book, Dirty Jokes and Beer, is a collection of some very funny jokes and humorous observations. It also includes some not-so-funny stuff about his suicide attempts and his father's death. Terry spoke with Drew Carey in 1997 and talked with him about his TV show, his books, and, of course, Dirty Jokes.
One of the chapters in your book is really a scream. It's 101 very funny jokes about the male member.
Yeah.
That's
a good way to put it for radio, sure.
Yeah. And these jokes are really funny.
My friends and I started doing them. I started with John Campanera on The Good Life when he showed me his one day as a joke. And I said, "What do you call that?" And I was making a jokes about, you know, mine is so big that, and he went, "Oh yeah, well mine is so big that." And we started making up these jokes, and I started remembering all of them in my head. And my friends would get together and we'd mention this thing, they'd always add in their own jokes. Everybody thought it was so funny, they'd try to add in their own jokes. And I started writing all these down, and pretty soon I had 101 of them. And most all of them I wrote myself, a lot of them came from my friends, and I credit them in the book. But they're really funny.
Can you tell a couple of them?
It's so big, it's right behind you. It's so big, there's still snow on it in the summertime. It's so big. I'm trying to clean these up for the radio. It's so big, it graduated a year ahead of me from high school. It's so big, Stephen Hawking has a theory about it. I love that one. It's so big, it has an opening act. It's so big, it only tips with hundreds. It's so big, it contains billions and billions of stars. It's so big.
It doesn't return Spielberg's calls.
It doesn't return Spielberg's calls. That's pretty big.
Oh, that's really funny.
It's so big, my mother was in labor for 3 extra days.
Oh, this is another joke I have to ask you to tell. This is the one about the beautiful woman who compliments the comic. I love this.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a clean one. That's like a typical comic insecurity joke. There's this comic gets he's in the bar Friday night and he's done working. And there's this really the most stunningly beautiful woman he's ever seen in his life sitting at the bar. And she says, "You were so funny tonight. I never laughed so hard. I think you're the sexiest guy in the world. I want to take you back to my place and make the most, the hottest love with you and just give you the wildest sexual trip you've ever had in your whole entire life right now." And he looks at her and he goes, "Did you see the first show or the second show?"
That is so great. I've heard that for jazz musicians, too, where the beautiful woman comes up to a jazz musician and he says, "So did you hear the first set or the second set?"
Yeah.
it's the best joke about self-absorbed artists I've heard.
There's a lot of those going around.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in your book, you seem to really want to communicate that you're not the TV character, Drew Carey, that he's a lot more lovable than you really are.
The guy on TV puts up with so much more crap than I would ever put up with in my life. And I have so much more ambition in my real life than the guy on TV does. You know, if that was the real Drew, I would have quit that job and try to start my own business. And, you know, I mean, a real business where I could make money. Buzz Beer isn't going so good on the show. But, I mean, when you're writing a book, it's like a personal letter, you know, almost to strangers. And so you want to let them know, like, "Hey, this is me, and I'm not," you know. You want to write it in your own voice and try to be some TV guy. Because I think the book, you know, I'm writing it, it was scaring me that the book might be around more than the TV show, you know. The book can sit around for a long time after the TV show's come and gone. It can be sitting on somebody's bookshelf in a library, you know, who knows.
Yeah, but the reruns come back to haunt you anyways.
Yeah, I know, but, yeah, hopefully.
That's right, if you're lucky.
In a perfect world, yeah.
Do you think you've managed to transform the 1950s square look into something really hip?
Maybe. You know, the only reason when I first started doing the act, I had the crew cut already and the glasses already from the Marine Corps Reserves. And I wore contact lenses when I was at work being a waiter. And then when I got off work, I'd take the contacts out and I put on my goofy glasses. I never knew how bad they looked until I started going on stage with them and people would laugh at me. The suit I bought at a Goodwill and... because that movie Stop Making Sense had just been out, and I thought, if I got a big, you know, old-style suit, that would be really hip to wear, and I look so bad in it, I can never wear it out, and I only wore it on stage to see if it would get a laugh for me, and it did. And it's not like I really tried all that hard to create a character, because it was pretty much, that was pretty much just me in a Goodwill suit that I'd already bought, you know, before I just started doing stand-up. But it might be a look. I don't know. Who knows?
Did the Marines make you wear those glasses?
Those are the official glasses. They have different ones now, but I think they let guys wear a certain kind of wires now. But then those were the official government-issued glasses. And when you had an inspection and stuff, that's what you had to wear. And during your work day, you could wear wire rims, you know. But for inspections and stuff like that, you had to wear the black, ugly. In the Marines, they called them, all through the service, they call them birth control glasses.
That's funny.
BCGs, yeah. And that's exactly why, too. They're so ugly.
You write in your book that, you don't know what humiliation is until you've shown up on your first day of junior high with moon boots and a snowsuit that your mother got on sale during the summer. Did your mother dress you badly when you were young?
No, it's just, she would. She would buy, like, the winter stuff on sale during the summer because that's when it's the cheapest. And she'd buy, you know, Christmas stuff for next year after Christmas when it all goes on sale before it gets all put away. And so... you know, you don't get the coolest stuff all the time when your mom's shopping like that because, you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. And but it's cold, man. I'm telling you, it gets cold in the winter in Cleveland, so you have to wear what you can to keep warm. I remember mom used to say, "Do you want to look good or do you want to stay warm?" And then after you get to be about 14 or 15, you think, heck, you know, I'm not even wearing a hat. That was like the big thing in my high school. Nobody wore a hat no matter what, no matter how cold. They would all let, you know, I would come home from wrestling practice or gym or whatever, my hair would be wet still, and I'd walk home, I would refuse to put a hat on because I didn't want to get hat hair. I have icicles in my hair. It'd be like the stupidest thing. And everybody in my school was like that except for the nerds, you know. They would wear the hats, and I didn't want to be one of them.
Right. Well, where would you have fit yourself in those days?
I don't know. I never, I was always pretty well-known and pretty popular. I mean, I was one of those kids that walked down the hall in high school without a pass, and everybody knew me.
Right.
You know? And all my friends were really funny, and I hung out with a group of guys that we were all really funny and liked to joke around a lot and play pranks and stuff. So I was in whatever that group is. That's the group I was in. And I wasn't very athletic, you know. And you know, I didn't want to go through high school without trying out for a sport. there was an announcement over the loudspeaker one day. Any boys interested in trying out for wrestling, come to the gym and bring your gym clothes. And so I tried out for wrestling. For 2 years, I went to wrestling practice, never even wrestled JV. I was really bad. But I really liked it. It taught me a lot, you know, about sticking to it and stuff. But it was like, I'm glad I had a sport experience in high school. And then I graduated a year early, so I only had the 2 years, and I skipped my senior year.
Mm.
You know, so I wasn't very athletic. I didn't do anything great that way. And then academically, I wasn't so hot. I got a B average without even trying. I mean, you just have to show up for class and take the test.
Well, you were funny in high school. Did you say to yourself, well, I could do this professionally?
I always say no in interviews. But then when I had a development deal at Disney once, and they were thinking of doing a show about me, and had my mom send out all these pictures of me from when I was a kid and all this stuff. She has a little file about, you know, like every mom does. And so one of the things in this file that she sent was, I think I wrote it when I was 14 or so, judging from the handwriting, and it was on steno paper, and I wrote down, like, things I wanted to do with my life, or be, you know. And on this list was stuff like, I want to be on the Johnny Carson show, I want to be a stand-up, I want to be a nightclub comic, I want to have a sitcom, I want to, you know, I want to star in a situation comedy or a play or something like that. It was all these kind of things that I'm doing now that I wrote down when I was 14, and then I just forgot about.
That's interesting.
You know,
yeah.
It freaked me out. It really freaked me out. I had no idea, you know, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. When I started doing stand-up comedy in my late 20s, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I had no goals, no direction, nothing. I just kind of fell into it. And so to see that list from when I was like 14 or 15 or whatever, however I was old when I wrote it, and I was like, wow, it must have been in the back of my mind somewhere.
Maybe you forgot it because it seems like such a long shot that it, you know, you didn't take it seriously.
Yeah, it was like one of these, like, big, it's like, you know, there was also stuff like, you know, pet a pony, you know, so. But it was like, I used to watch, when I was in junior high and high school, I used to watch The Tonight Show all the time if there was a comic on. I wouldn't watch The Johnny Carson Show normally, only if there was a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always look at the TV guide. If it said comedian so-and-so, I'd always make sure I'd watch and see who the comic was. And I think that's where I got the idea that, I would love to do that someday. And I wrote down, you know, be a nightclub comic, be on The Johnny Carson Show. And it all came true. I can't believe, you know, it's weird.
You enlisted in the Marine Reserve Corps.
Right.
How old were you when you did it? What was your motivation?
I was like 23, I must have been. It was in 80. I needed money. I needed a job. I was, it was always in the back, you know, I must've been from playing with army men when I was a kid or something, but it's always, you know, being in the military was always in the back of my mind as a last resort. If nothing else ever worked out, you could always join the army. You know, that's always how I thought. And, I was living in Las Vegas and having a really bad time, and I got thrown out of my motel room that I was living in because I couldn't pay the rent. And I had my car that was totaled in the first place, had everything stolen out of it. So all it was left with was like the clothes on my back and a few other things that they didn't take. And so my buddy gave me a ride to L.A. to stay with my brother, who lived in Mission Viejo. My brother took me in and got me a job, bought me some clothes. And he worked for a Porsche Audi dealer, and I would deliver parts in Southern California in this van. That was my job. And he was the parts manager. And when the owner of the place found out that he didn't want relatives working for relatives because it would be easy to steal from the place then. And so my brother had to fire me from that job.
Oh, no.
So I was in Mission Viejo. My brother had to fire me. And I didn't want to mooch off him, you know. And all I had was a little bit of clothes that he bought me. I mean, he had to buy me underwear and everything. I didn't have anything when I showed up at his door because everything was stolen out of my car after I got kicked out of my motel room. And so I thought, I'll just join the service. And I went to the recruiting office, and I went to the Navy thing, and I talked to those guys. And while I was in the, before I could go in, I was in the lobby, and the Marine guy came out and saw me, and he looked really squared away and everything. He said, look, make sure you see me before you leave. So after I saw the Navy guys, I went over to visit with the Marine guy, and he was, you know, he was just a good salesman, man. He talked me to join the Marines. And I thought, if I'm going to join the service, I just want to join the toughest one, you know, and get it over with. I don't want to take the easy way out. Doing this, I'm just doing this one time, you know, because you just can't switch branches of service throughout your life and go through boot camp after boot camp. So I joined the Marines, and it was great.
What was great
about
it?
I really liked it. Well, first of all, I got 3 meals a day. I was earning my own money. I was so happy to, I mean, after that, you know, mooching off my brother and getting kicked out of my motel in Vegas, I was so happy just to have a job. And they really are good at building like a team spirit and a camaraderie. You know, and every day you get done, you really feel like you've been doing something, you know, and accomplishing something. And I was getting, I was running and getting in shape, and you know, and I was older than a lot of the guys in the platoon, you know. So I knew what they were doing, like psychologically when they were doing stuff to me. So I mean, they could yell. I just stood there. Didn't bother me, you know. And I, you know, I knew they weren't out to hurt me. So everything they said to do, I would just do it as fast as I could right away. And I trusted them, you know. And a lot of people think you go to boot camp and they go, oh, the drill instructor's out to really, he's going to try to hurt you. That's his job. But it's not his job. The drill instructor's job is to make you into a Marine and to get you through this training. And all you have to do is, I'm telling you, I just totally trusted him. I thought, this guy's really not going to hurt me. You know, I just got to do what he says. And so that's all I did. And it came out, it worked out really well. I graduated from boot camp with a meritorious PFC. I got a top 10% of my, they give the guys in the top 10% of the platoon a meritorious promotion. So I got meritorious PFC out of boot camp, and really did good. I really liked the reserves. I had a lot of friends. I liked the life, you know.
This is great. Really, the Marines kind of gave you a sense of accomplishment, a sense of self-esteem, and a look.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. The Marines were pretty good to me. I'm telling you, man, I'd still be in the Marine Reserves if I wasn't doing stand-up. I quit because I was making, you know, I saw the money you could make doing weekends, and I was only making like $125 a weekend in the reserves as a sergeant, you know, and I thought, you know, then I could make $300 on a weekend if I was a stand-up comic starting out. So why would I give up that $300, you know, for the whole 120s? So I quit during the Marines.
What was your first brush with professional comedy?
Just doing the, working that one club in Canton. I lived in Cleveland, and the guy that owned the Cleveland club owned a club in Canton. He put me in his Canton club for a week, 9 shows for $100. That was my first professional paid gig. I got like $10 a show.
What was your first time on stage like?
Oh, the very first time I ever tried to do jokes on stage, I was living in Las Vegas, and it was horrible. I was terrible. I tried, you know, I didn't know how to write jokes. I just, you know, kind of like jokes that I kind of heard, and, you know, observations that weren't funny that were like, oh, my God, it was like the worst. I still have notes from those days that I save. And, oh, my God, the worst. Ugh, I can't tell you how bad. That was in like in 79 and then like in 8. I just did it as a goof just to see what it would be like. It was the Sahara Talent Showcase at the Sahara Hotel, their lounge. They let anybody get up there. And then I, you know, I went to Cleveland in 80, and there was a guy starting a comedy club there, and late 79, early 80, and he wanted local comics, and he just put me on just for, because I could breathe and stand up and talk. And I remember the very first time, he didn't pay the MCs, he only paid the headliners, so I didn't get any money, but he worked me once, and I remember the first night I did, it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and the first night I did 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, supposed to do 10 minutes. Then Friday, they said, why don't you do just 5? And then Saturday, they said, look, don't do any time. Just bring the other guys up. They cut me down. They didn't want me to just do anything because I was that bad. I think I did it twice. And then I said, well, I can't do this. This is silly. You know, at least I tried it and got it out of my system. I was going to college then and everything. And I thought, I'll just, you know, I did it as a goof. I got it out of my system. I'm going to try it again. And I never did. And I thought, well, that was just it. So then later on in 86, when my, you know, in late 85, my friend said, hey, he remembered from when I used to be I met him when I tried to do stand-up. He always thought it was funny. And when I was having trouble, you know, paying rent, I got in a fight with my boss where I was waiting tables. And he said, hey, if you want to think of any jokes for my radio show, I'll pay you. I went, oh, how much? And he goes, $20 a joke or so. And I thought, oh, I can make an extra $100 a week. And I went to the library and I finally got a book on how to write jokes. And from reading that book, that's what really started me. I thought, oh, wow, there's a formula to this. I could write jokes.
How did the book help you write jokes?
There's formulas for every kind of joke writing. I mean, there really is.
Give me an example.
Easily learned. Well, the example they used in the book, the first example I used was they take driving. You write driving at the top of the page, and then you write down. It's all about list making, joke writing, writing one-liners. It's all about list making. So you write driving, then you write down everything you can think of that relates to driving. You know, angry drivers, slow drivers, fast drivers. You know, new cars, old cars, junk cars, you know, car washes, you know, red lights, and you write all this stuff down, and then you try to exaggerate something to make it bigger than it is. You try to use plays on words. If there's words that sound like other words, you try to make puns up that way. You can make jokes like that, and you use all these different techniques to take these little all these little lists you made, you know, and even angry women drivers, angry men drivers, you know. And you try to, when you detail it down, you try to make every little thing exaggerated or minimalize it or twist it around. And then you try to make like, you know, 20 jokes and try to get one good joke out of that. And that's how you come up with one good joke. It should take, you know, if you're starting out, it takes you like 3 hours.
I can't believe you actually honed your technique through a book.
Yeah. I'm really big on self-help, you know, so I always try to get a book at the library or a book on whatever I want to learn. I try to learn it from a some kind of book.
Well, Drew Carey, it's really been fun having you on the show. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Drew Carey speaking to Terry Gross in 1997. A new Warner Brothers home video release called Television Favorites: The Drew Carey Show comes out next week, presenting 6 of the show's best episodes.